I'm John Kroll. Coming up on No Limits, we're going to talk about the things that make us laugh. We're going to talk about what's funny and what isn't. We're going to talk about humor and comedy. My guests will be two guys who have been making people laugh for years. Dave Wilson, a comedian and the manager of Crackers Comedy Club, and Dick Wolvesy, writer, humorist, and syndicated humor columnist. Please join the conversation. Call us at 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Twitter is WFYI. And Facebook is nolimits@wfyi. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by your membership and by Apparatus IT Security, identifying network vulnerabilities to help keep companies secure. More information on security assessments for businesses at apparatus.net. And by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th State University. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about humor and comedy. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Twitter is WFYI and Facebook is nolimits@wfyi. Well, my guests are two guys who have been making people in Indiana laugh for years. Dave Wilson, who is a comedian and manager of Crackers Comedy Club. Welcome to the program, Dave.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. These are fabulous facilities.
It's good to have you here. And Dick Wolvesy has a resume that's as long as a lot of books. Writer, humorist, syndicated humor columnist, TV personality.
Thank you, John.
He's done everything. Good to have you here, Dave.
My pleasure.
Well, let's start a little bit. What makes people laugh? I mean, let's start with that. Or at least, how do you go about trying to make people laugh? I'll start with Dave first.
Wow. Well, I don't know. I think it's just pointing out something that's with some irony to it, that's ironic to people, and something they can relate to. That's why when you go to stand-up, you see stand-up. A lot of stand-up comics talk about things which are generic subjects. In other words, being married, dating, going to McDonald's, because everybody's had those experiences, and so they can relate to them. And so
it's got to be kind of universal or allegorical.
But then you get people that can take the better stand-ups, can take those same subjects or other subjects and make them unique or make them their own.
How do you go about, I mean, how long have you been doing stand-up?
I started doing comedy in 1980, but I started seriously trying to do stand-up in 1983. And walked into Crackers and then started, I'm going to start trying to be a stand-up comedian. And that was in February of 83. And then in October of 83, I quit my day job and moved back into my parents' unfinished basement. I was 28. Uh-huh. And started trying to do stand-up. And just because I had met Jay Leno, and Leno had given me a lot of advice. And he said, the thing, if you want to be a better stand-up comedian, you need to live off the money you make doing stand-up comedy, because there's no greater incentive to get better.
What prompted you to want to be a stand-up? I mean, you know, in my mind, I think, oh, boy, you know, having to stand up in front of people for a period of time, mm-hmm. and keep them entertained by, telling jokes, mm-hmm. My thought goes to, boy, couldn't I just schedule a root canal or something more pleasant instead?
I liked... When I was young, in my 20s, I liked being the center of attention. I liked getting that reaction from people. Mm-hmm. And when you get a laugh in front of a group of people, it's heroin.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's absolutely. And it's universal, too.
Right.
I mean, the wonderful thing about laughter is I always tell people at speeches, if there was a group of people in the next room from Vietnam or the Congo or somewhere and they were laughing, it would be indistinguishable. They maybe laugh at different things.
It's universal,
The sound of laughter is universal, and it is. Dave's right. It's magical, really.
Well, we were talking before we went on the air about the difference between what you guys try to do. I mean, Dave is really a comedian, and that's his focus. And Dick, you were making a distinction, and it's one that, and, you know, I remember a famous interview James Garner, the actor James Garner, did, where he said, "I don't do comedy, I do humor."
Yeah,
it's different.
Yeah.
How is it different?
Well, a lot of what Dave says is absolutely true. You're looking for irony. Humor is a very intellectual process. And I always tell people when I speak that if you're talking about jokes, for example, and that is at the end of the joke, the punchline, you're really asking the reader to fill in sort of some blanks and making you think. I mean, there's so many examples. You know, George Carlin once had a line that's just one of my favorites. He said, "The first baseball team in history were the Cincinnati Redlegs." He said, "In 1873, they were the first team." And then he goes, "Who did they play?" Well, that in order to laugh at that joke, you have to make some things in your mind. You have to be some synapses. You have to fill in the missing information. And every joke and every punchline is really sort of an unexpected truth. I always tell, you know, the thing about my wife's Valentine's Day card this year was, "I love you more today than yesterday." And you open it up and it says, "Yesterday you pissed me off." Well, that is an unexpected truth. But to get that joke, you have to make all the connections.
When did you start writing?
I was a funny kid. I think, Dave, you said you were too. I mean, I remember the first joke I ever told when I was 5 years old. And I remember I had to write it 1,000 times. I did. I was in the third or fourth grade. And I remember the teacher said to the kid in front of me, he said he was chewing a pencil. And he said to Mark Fisher, he said, "What would happen if you swallowed that pencil?" And I raised my hand and I said, he could borrow my pen. And I had to write that 1,000 times. And I remember thinking, wow, that's a great reaction. I mean, that must be really powerful stuff, you know, if they make you write something like that 1,000 times. So
did you get a laugh with the first one?
Oh, I got a huge laugh. And I think, you know, like Dave says, it's something that, you know, I think you're born with a sense of humor. I think as a writer, I've developed it. But I think there are people who just are born funny.
We're talking about humor and comedy here on No Limits. Please join the conversation by giving us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Email's nolimits@wfyi.org. Twitter is WFYI, and Facebook is No Limits WFYI. When do you know a joke works, Dave? I mean, when you're sitting there, because obviously it's not like you're just going up and doing improv every night.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, when you come up with a joke and you go up in front of an audience, and if it gets a laugh, then okay. But it can work in front of some audiences and not work in front of other audiences or different situations. Or you could
tell it differently by accident.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Or you stick it in different parts of your act. Some jokes, people have to know you and like you before they will appreciate the joke.
Such as, give me an example, could you?
I used to talk about my wife and I got married, and we didn't have a big wedding. We just ran downtown to Indianapolis here, Justice of the Peace. I give this guy $30 and we're married. Then we go back home. I walk in the house, phone's ringing. You know, I screwed it up here because my wife, when I first met my wife, let me start again.
All right, go ahead.
See, you can't do this in a comedy club.
Yeah, because here's the whole thing about jokes, too, is that you have to work out the timing and the phrase.
Exactly. Yeah.
So how I should have set it up was that when I first met my wife, she already owned a house. She was a homeowner. She's a young lady, beautiful, already owned a house. So we decided to get married, go downtown, Justice of the Peace, give the guy $30. We go back to the house, walk in the house, phone rings. It's a friend of mine. "Hey, Dave, what's new?" And I go, "Well, I just bought a house for $30. But if you do that early enough, women get mad at you. Feel like you're using this woman. So, but if I would do it later in my set, it would get a huge laugh. But if I did it right up front, it never worked. I
mean, how do you set a joke up like that up, though? I mean, when you say you know it's got to be later in the act. Obviously, it seems to me from what you're saying here, you got to establish that you really love your wife.
You
got to make that clear for the joke to work. How do you go about doing that?
Well, you just have to get on stage. You have to do it. Doing stand-up is not like doing and like when Dick writes an article, if he didn't like it, go back. That don't sound right. And you rewrite it. Or if you're learning to play piano or guitar, you practice in the safety of your own house. Doing stand-up, it's like doing live radio. You know, if you screw up the setup,
have fiddled with that joke endlessly before you put it on.
You got to do it. Like I talked about starting stand-up, trying to seriously be a stand-up comedian in 1983. Mm-hmm. And I kept working and kept working. Well, in 1986, I did 424 shows. I was on stage every night, seven nights a week, except Christmas Day is the only day in 1986 I was not on stage. And I went from being able to do 20 minutes pretty well to being able to do 50 minutes very well.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's repetition and doing it over and over and over and over, so that no matter what's going on, that comedy's coming out of your brain, and you can search your other half of your brain for another joke that might mm-hmm. work in another situation, or be cognizant of what's going on in the room so that you can adjust what you're doing.
Yeah, and that's why Leno and Seinfeld still do clubs, because you want to find if the joke works, and mm-hmm. then you want to fine-tune it. And all the great comedians will tell you that there are jokes that they will actually work on for months
right.
in order to get the timing exactly yeah. exactly right. I mean, Neil Simon, the great playwright, used to say that, you know, he was never popular in France, because he was the master of the three-liner. I mean, once mm-hmm. you translate it, it loses all its timing because all the rhythm is wrong.
Yeah,
yeah.
And I feel the same way when I write. I'll sometimes right. rewrite a sentence 10, 20 times because I want everything to just be in perfect rhythm to make the joke
right.
work.
I mean, if you're doing 400 plus shows mm-hmm. in the course of a year, mm-hmm. I mean, it's a pretty basic question. Do you ever get tired of the joke?
No, because it's heroin.
Yeah.
I mean,
you're after the laugh. You're not after the joke.
It's boom, do that bit and bang, and you know it's coming. I mean, when you can make a bunch of people happy, or you can see, you got to have an act too. So you start off one way. And you got to have a start, a middle, and an end in your act, whether you're doing 5 minutes or 50 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And what you do is you work your new stuff in, or things you're working on in between the start, in the middle, and then it. But you always have something, if something fails, that you can go right back into to get a laugh, so that you know is going to work. And so, no, those jokes that there's no jokes now that I'm doing that I've started when I started. But one joke I keep trying to re-enter into my act, but it doesn't work, and now I just do it as a joke. I set it up as a joke I did when I first started, and it was about Prince Charles and Lady Diana. And of course, she's passed now, so it's kind of hard to move her, you know, to enter. But I love that joke so much that I try to introduce it into my act now still. But it's kind
of... See, now,
go ahead, you set it up. Go ahead and tell us the joke.
Well, I used to, and again, this is 1983, and this is one of the first jokes I ever did that really worked. Got a big laugh. That was an original joke, but I talk about how, you know, if you've seen Prince Charles and Lady Diana, I mean, why would a good-looking girl like Lady Diana marry some ugly-looking dude like Prince Charles? And invariably, some ladies in the audience go, you know, money, money. I go, yeah, but money, have you seen the ears on this guy? If he went running through a cornfield, he'd sound like baseball cards on bicycles. So that was my favorite song.
And you're trying to bring it back, but unfortunately, a lot of people, you got younger audiences who probably don't even remember who Princess Diana was.
Right. Now.
So we're talking about comedy and humor here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. Dick, where does, since the medium you use most is writing. I mean, it's the, and not to say that obviously there's not writing in stand-up, but mm-hmm. clearly there is. The humor has to translate, though, off of the printed page. You can't shade inflection with your voice.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, my whole career here in Indianapolis was really making people laugh on television.
Yeah.
I mean, because I did silly stuff on TV. But it is an interesting transition, because I always was basically a writer, and it is different. I always tell the story, and it's absolutely true. I really don't always expect people say to me, oh, your article was so funny. But I think laughter is a very social thing. That's why it's heroin today, because you hear 200 people laughing. When you're alone sitting there, I'm not saying people never laugh. I'm not saying you don't read things that you laugh. It's a lot harder to laugh when you're sitting alone. I mean, I'll watch – my wife sometimes will read a piece I've written, and I write one every week. I've done it for 600 mm-hmm. weeks. And sometimes you can't see me now, but sometimes she'll read the whole thing, and her expression will not change. And she will say, this is the funniest thing you've written in 6 months. And she will not crack a smile. But I don't get angry at that, because it's an appreciation mm-hmm. for its cleverness
right.
mm-hmm. and what you've done. And because what I do is I take something that has happened to me every week, and I turn it into a funny story. So, for example, you look to the gods when something like this happens. Several months ago, I went on Medicare, and I got a letter from the Medicare company after 3 months that said, we cannot cover you for your prostate exam because we have you listed as a woman. And I looked up, I looked to the heavens
you,
and I said, thank you, comedy gods.
Yeah.
Because I now have something to write about 600 words.
Yeah.
So whenever something happens like that, you say, okay, you know, you have to turn it into an essay.
We are talking about humor and comedy here on No Limits. Join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Dave Wilson and Dick Wolvesy. I'm John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about humor and comedy today on No Limits. My guests are Dave Wilson, comedian and manager of Cracker's Comedy Club, and Dick Wolvesy, man of all trades, writer, humorist, syndicated humor columnist, TV personality. We've gotten a question from a listener who didn't want to go on the air, and if you'd like to reach out to us, why don't you send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. It says, Dick's wife, Marianne, has previously appeared on No Limits. She is obviously an intelligent, articulate, thoughtful woman. How did she end up with a loser like Dick? Clearly, this has got to be someone. It's a listener named Jerry. So,
well, it can't be. It couldn't be my wife because her name is Mary Ellen, and I don't think she'd get her own name wrong.
Okay.
Was that a serious question?
I don't know.
That's the most common question people ask. We are very different. We are very different. I look at, I'll just leave it at that. I'll just leave it at that. Oh. I do write about her in my, I would say 30 to 40% of my columns make fun of her. But really, most of the time, I make fun of myself. And I bet Dave would agree that really the best kind of humor is self-deprecating
humor. Most
certainly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you're talking about how certain situations, somebody sitting alone, it's, you know, at comedy clubs and the whole psychology of comedy, we pack people together. They pack people together. A, you want to get as many people as you can in there. But even in a room that's half full, you try
because
to put people
together.
Because
laughter is contagious, right?
You put people close to each other because laughter is contagious.
Well, the other thing is, again, I'm not a stand-up comic, but I've sort of studied this. Dave's doing a room, and it's all the people from the same business. You better make the boss laugh. Because they're looking to the boss for permission to laugh at something edgy. Am I right?
Yeah. Well, if you get a little blue or something like that.
Yeah, you better. The boss better like it.
Right.
Well, and are there, you know, it sounds like, at least what I'm picking up so far, is that the basis of both humor and comedy tends to be observational, has to be something that...
And intellectual.
Yeah, and connects to people's experience in some fashion. But there are, you know, there are things that... we don't think of as comedy or whatever. Are there certain subjects that you just can't touch, that they aren't funny?
Well, I suppose it depends on who the audience is and the situation. After 9/11, you know, Gilbert Godfrey went on and started doing playing into building jokes and just outraged everybody. And they weren't funny, but he was just being Gilbert Godfrey.
You know, the 9/11 thing is interesting because the late night hosts had an issue with that too when they would come back and when they would do comedy. I think the answer to this is there's a gentleman who was Bill Clinton's comedy writer. His name is Katz, Michael Katz, I think it is, and he's sort of a friend of mine. And we were talking about what you could make fun of, and he always said, you know, you can make fun of the smoke, but you can't make fun of the fire. And let me give you an example. After 9/11, I love The New Yorker. And I was wondering at what point there would be any kind of a cartoon that had any reference at all to 9/11. Because as Dave says, that seems sort of taboo. And I remember the first cartoon I saw. And this is when all the security was heightened. And it was a guy and his friend going into a restaurant. And you saw, you know, that detector that they put on people, you know, to see if they have metal. And the New Yorker caption was, I think it was something like, the food sucks, but the security is great. That was clearly a reference to 9/11. But it wasn't making fun of people dying. It was making fun of things around 9/11. You know what Stewart does? If something horrible happens, this quick example, Michael Jackson. Mm-hmm. You don't want to make fun of Michael Jackson's death. But what Jon Stewart did, he would make fun of the coverage of Michael Jackson's death, mm-hmm. which was hysterical the way Jon Stewart did it. But he didn't make fun of Michael dying. And there's a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it depends on what your goal is. Mm-hmm. Are you trying to make a statement mm-hmm. with your jokes, mm-hmm. or are you just trying to entertain people?
Mm-hmm.
And
which direction do you go?
For years, it was just entertain people, mm-hmm. and now it's more. I mix it up a little more.
Okay. And, so could you give me an example of a joke where you try to make a statement?
Oh.
I know I'm catching you here. Uh-huh. Yeah.
My act before was just basically being married, dating, going out and doing different things like that. Now I'm trying to, do jokes about, one of the themes that I'm trying to work on now, and this is still in the early age stages, is how as Christians or how as people, you know what you're supposed to do, but you kind of rationalize your way out of doing the right thing and how easy it is to forget how to do the right thing. For example, you go to church. How many times have you gone to church and you've done the Lord's Prayer?
Mm-hmm.
And forgive my trespasses as I forgive people who trespass against me. And then you step out in the street, somebody cuts you off in your car, and you're flipping them off, you know, two blocks later.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's that irony, and I'm trying to bring that out and make people laugh at how we rationalize not doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm. Are there moments when you're thinking, okay, this is sad? Is it a greater challenge, I guess, is where I'm going with this, to take something that is sad or somewhat heavy, like 9/11, and cut through that kind of gloom and give people a release by making them laugh about it seeing some glimmer of humor in it?
What I love to see now is, and being the manager at Crackers, I see a lot of new young comedians coming through all the time.
Yeah.
And I see a lot of the young black comedians talking about race in a way that they wouldn't have, nobody. Well, Richard Pryor maybe did back in the 70s,
mm-hmm.
but talking about it in a very frank manner.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it that's very refreshing, and it brings kind of a relief to people.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the things that I've seen nowadays that I think it helps relations and build relations when you kind of ease a lot of that tension that's possibly in the room from race relations.
We've gotten a question from a listener who didn't want to go on the air, asking sort of the business of comedy here, and I'm assuming this one's pitched toward Dave. You know,
what, I'm not
like,
making a living?
You are. You
what
are.
Was that? What is that supposed to
but
mean?
But you're not making a living doing stand-up. And what,
but
this
I'm
is
making
what this,
a living. I'm a little insulted right. about this whole
what,
thing, actually.
This is what...
Well, go ahead, Dave, before I go on welfare. Why don't you answer the question?
Speaks to it. How do you get paid? I mean, is it by the set? Is it
by the laugh?
By the laugh. Yeah, is it an incentive system here?
Well, it depends on the venue. Like at Crackers, the opening acts, they get paid for the week. And that pay will vary. It's pretty much the same for the opening acts and the feature performers. But then the headliners, the pay will range quite a bit, depending on whether how good you are and then how many seats you sell, or if you even do sell seats. So it can range a lot. But comedy clubs are basically just a training area. They're not an end-all.
Mm-hmm.
They're an area for you to go and work on your act and then go and go your own different way. And
can you make a living doing it, though?
But it's a hard living.
The truth of the matter is that if you are good at what you do, you can make more money doing a corporation for a half an hour, IBM luncheon, than you can all week at Crackers.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, one thing the Bob and Tom show has done has made a lot of people. They made me well-known here in Central Indiana. And so I could go out and do different gigs and make a lot of dough here in Central Indiana doing that. Now that they're nationally syndicated, there's a lot of guys, they have their own tour where they go to different markets where their stations are there, and guys get paid very handsomely for that because people know who they are and they come out to see them.
We are talking about humor and comedy here on No Limits. Please join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook, No Limits, WFYI, or on Twitter, WFYI. Dick, you know, some of it, since so much of you say 30% to 40% of what you write about is often connected with your wife or
family,
observations
right.
or family. And a lot of it, your style is very sort of down home, close to the earth, watching people and the things that they do and mm-hmm. finding humor in that. Do people get wary around you at all and think, oh, gosh, well, you know, if I do something a little silly here, I'm going to end up in one of Dick's columns?
Well, I know. Or... I mean, I've been very lucky because, I mean, some people always say, don't put me in your book. Don't put me in your column. Don't put me on the radio. Don't put me on TV. I sort of, you know, I have sort of my fingers in everything. And that's a great mm-hmm. thing. I mean, Dave's talking about the heroine of laughter. But I have a wonderful opportunity because I have so many different ways when mm-hmm. something happens to me to share it. Mm-hmm. And again, that's the joy that when something happens, that I can say, okay, this will make a funny 600 words. How do I take this one thought? My wife's most common thing she says to me, I'll say to her, that something happened. And I'll say, well, the other day it's like Dave's hard to think of an example. My dog got loose and he ran into the grocery store in the parking lot and got into the store. So I went to the lady at the counter and I said, my dog is loose in the store. She said, well, I'll make an announcement. What kind of a dog is it? Now, for some reason, that struck me funny. So I went home and I told my wife the story. And she always says the same thing. She says, well, you can't make a whole column out of that.
Right.
But I do. That one incident, what kind of a dog is it? Gave me a whole column, and that's what you have to do.
We've gotten a question from a listener named Jim via Facebook.
Who doesn't want to be on the air. Supposing Dave and I had that attitude.
Well, he's reaching out to us through Facebook, the miracle of social media here. And says, long-time listener, first-time caller. Well, you're not calling, Jim, so that's one problem. How did Dave the King Wilson actually become the king? And then he says, thanks, and I'll take my answer offline.
Right.
Well, not much, many other options here. So,
I started seriously trying to do stand-up in February of 83, and Bob and Tom came to town probably in March or April of 83. And Tom saw me at an open stage, Monday night open stage here in town, and said, hey, why don't you come on the show tomorrow morning? I said, okay. And at that point, I'd been doing stand-up about 3 months, and I had 8 minutes of jokes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went on the Bob and Tom show that morning for the first time, and I did all 8 minutes of my job.
And then that's it. You got nothing left.
And when the show was over, Tom goes, man, that was great. Come back next week. And I went,
that's great.
So at that point, off stage, a bunch of comics in central, all over the Midwest here, we were all doing Elvis off stage.
Yeah.
It was like, we're the king. And so I just developed this character, the king. Mm-hmm. And if Elvis were still alive, he'd probably be doing jokes. And it's easier to write jokes for a character than it is for somebody you don't know. For example, if somebody you don't know said, I was 20 years old till I found out gravy wasn't a soft drink, you're thinking, mm-hmm. what? Mm-hmm. But if Elvis, premised that up punchline, oh, man, I was 20 years old till I found out gravy wasn't a soft drink. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
So then I started writing jokes for this character, and it took off, and then Tom started calling me Dave the King Wilson, and so that's
been See, Dave nice. Makes an interesting point, though, because – you know, if you did vaudeville in the 20s or the 30s or 40s, you could do the same act mm-hmm. for 40 years.
Yeah.
But now, not so much the comedy clubs, but if you go on television, you can't go on Letterman and then show up 3 days later on Arsenio Hall and do the same stuff. People saying, "I just heard that."
Well, and that
so
was
it,
the
it eats material.
And more than point, that was the complaint always about the Tonight Show. You know, when Johnny Carson completely died, is that it was the big break and it put you in front of it, and but then, you'd burn through your material and not be able to use it anywhere else.
7 million people just heard it.
How hard is it? I mean, I know in the newspaper business, which is where I sprang up. It was always the assumption always was that you burn through your material a lot faster when you're trying to write humor. There's a reason that, say, a Mike Royko or a Tom Keating in this market would be doing 5 columns a week and Dave Barry was doing 1.
No, that's true.
How hard is it to find the material?
Somebody once asked me, I'm in 40 newspapers. Somebody once said, is it the same column in every newspaper? Are you serious? I would be in a straitjacket if I had to write 40 columns a week. Is it the same column in every newspaper?
Right.
How much time you talked about that 8 minutes you were doing, Dave.
Right.
How long did it take you to?
It had taken me 3 months to come up with that 8 minutes. Of polished material. And again, I was doing writing comedy is like a muscle.
Yeah.
And the more you do it and the more stage time you get for a stand up, the more prolific you are. But you have to constantly be writing and trying something new and trying something different constantly, and it just takes time.
How did you come up with the material? You said you came back to Bob and Tom after burning through your first 3 months.
I sat and wrote material about, like Elva, I go, okay, boys, here I am, I'm the king. So play 2001, and I just came up, I just wrote a bunch of Elvis, you know. Oh, man, I'm buried out in my backyard like a pet gerbil.
You know, there are two answers to the question. People say, how long does it take you to write a column?
Yeah.
And there are two answers to that question. One is 2 hours, and the other is a week. Because on all the way down here on the highway, I had an idea for a column, and I'm thinking about how I want to do that. Do I count that? You just don't count the time sitting at the computer.
Right.
Because
mm-hmm.
when you get here, if you're thinking of a joke, you're thinking of that all the way home. Mm-hmm. How can I fiddle with that? How can I make that better? And that really, it really does take me, in a way, 2 hours, and in a way, it takes me a week to write a column.
How is the struggle always finding the conception, you know, the
thing that,
because I know I don't write comedy, but I've been writing a newspaper column for close to 30 years.
Once I have the idea, John, once I have the idea, I am really very good at what I do. The problem is that it's due Sunday night at midnight. And if something hasn't happened to me by Thursday at noon, I start to panic. And I'll tell you something interesting. My wife's been ill lately, and I haven't been getting out as much. Mm-hmm. And if you don't go out and things don't happen to you, there are no ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's where things are. And I wrote a funny column about staring at the four walls. But, you know, after that, I was lost because nothing interesting happens when you're at home.
Mm-hmm. We've gotten an email question from a listener named Jane who says, you briefly touched on humor losing its potency when translated to another language. This is something all speakers should be aware of if they are using an interpreter. Hmm. As an English to American Sign Language interpreter, I'm often confronted with someone trying to be funny when speaking English and the humor is lost on a deaf audience. The type of humor will make a difference. If it's a play on words, it will take forever to explain mm-hmm. to the deaf person who really doesn't use English words fluently. Of course, the opposite also is also true. Deaf comedians being interpreted into English often leave the hearing audience confused or lost because the humor is in the visual mode, is part of the language, and only another deaf person or a fluent interpreter will catch the part that is, in fact, funny. You know, in terms of audience, I mean, we've talked about this. Humor is intellectual. It's, you know, it's observational and all of that. It's really about a relationship. I mean, it's a there has to be that sense of connection.
Well, one of the advantages I have as a stand-up over Dick who's writing a column is that my facial expressions or mannerisms on stage can add to the joke. And it can also subconsciously broadcast, here comes the punchline. And I can do that subconsciously with how I move. But so that's an advantage. But talking about trying to do with different language, trying to communicate with people in different languages, I had an opportunity several years ago, to work on St. Martin, which is half French, half Dutch. And one night, the shows were almost all tourists. There was a handful of locals, but they were almost all tourists. And this was on the Dutch side, but one night there was a table of eight French-only speaking people sitting right in the middle of the room, and they had an interpreter. And so I would do a joke, and then the interpreter would lean in and translate the joke into French. And so not only was this horribly distracting to everybody.
And throws the timing.
It throws the timing, because there's no way I could go on while this guy's talking, you know. And plus, then he would relay the joke, and they would just stare at it. It was not a laugh. I mean, everybody else was laughing, and he would nothing, dead, man. I mean, he was not able.
And there's nothing worse than
doing
something and not getting a laugh. I don't have to face that with that.
Right.
If people don't like the column, it's over with, and they say, wasn't that funny this week?
Well, and you weren't sitting right in front of them.
They're not sitting right in front of me.
What's it like when they don't laugh, Dave?
Well, different. I mean, you know what? Here's the whole thing you have to tell yourself.
I'll tell you what. Let's hold that and catch it on the other side.
You got it.
We are talking about humor and comedy here on No Limits. Join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. My guests are comedian, manager of Crackers Comedy Club, Dave Wilson, and humorist Dick Wolvesey. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about humor and comedy here on No Limits. My guests are Dave Wilson, who is comedian and manager of Cracker's Comedy Club, and Dick Wolfsey, who's a writer, humorist, syndicated humor columnist, TV personality, radio personality, basically everywhere in the media world. Dick Wolfsey is there. We were talking actually in the break here, and Dick was talking about a situation where he was talking to an audience, and I know, Dave, you were mentioning something, but I want to get to this too. You kind of took a risk, you know, set up the story you were just telling us off the air, where you were talking to an all female audience.
Well, it's too long to get into the specific, but the point that Dave can relate to is that there is a culture of that audience, and you sort of have to read that culture when you come in. And I don't have that. That's a good thing and a bad thing. When I write the column, I just write what I think is funny for the most people. But when I walk to do a speech, the difference between Dave and me is I do a lot of presentations where I am very funny. And by the way, that's another interesting thing. I never, ever call myself a comedian, because if I call myself a comedian, I walk into that room.
Expectations.
There has an expectation. Mm-hmm. And then when I get to it in my speech, I go, "You're really funny." Well, that's because you didn't expect me to be. When you stand in front of that crowd, right, you better be funny, because somebody just paid $20 to hear. Am I right?
Right. Oh, yeah.
How much of humor, though, and comedy is risk, in the sense that you got to push people a little bit beyond where they're comfortable?
Again, it depends on whether you're going to entertain them or you're wanting to make a point. And so different situations call for different types of jokes. Talking about, you know, bombing in front of people, it's different bombing now than it was when I first started. When I first started, it was, you know, I didn't know what to do, and I wasn't confident in my material. Now I'm pretty confident in my material, and I'm confident in what I've done. And as Bill Cosby said, somebody asked Bill Cosby one time what the secret to success was. He goes, "I don't know. But I know the key to failure is trying to please everybody." Mm-hmm. And you're not going to please everybody. And because of media today, newspapers, television, radio, social media, people all over the United States are exposed to a lot of, can be exposed to a lot of the same things. Mm-hmm. So if you go into an audience at a comedy club that's just made of the general public, chances are any references you make to anything, they're going to get. But you can go into a select audience in a group, and if you're not a part of that group, you can be an outsider right away. A similar situation, back when I first started, there was a B'nai B'rith convention here in Indianapolis. And they were at the Crackers up at Keystone at the Crossing. There was 250 of them. People from all over the United States, B'nai B'rithers. And I had nothing to relate to these folks. I was probably 31 years old. You know, I'm a Christian. I didn't know nothing about the Jewish faith. And so I get up in front of these folks, and it's just, you can hear crickets. Mm-hmm. And so finally, I'm trying to talk to folks about where they're from. And this is how idiot I am. I was going to go, "Where are you from, sir?" He goes, "Kansas." I go, "Hey, I hear they got great ribs there." Well, boom. But I didn't even put the canal. I wasn't trying to make fun of him. Sure. That's when I thought of Kansas City, I thought of barbecue and ribs. Okay. Yeah. So it wasn't going anywhere. And finally, this guy starts heckling me in Yiddish. And I start trying to interpret what he was saying. And that got laughs. And I was only had to do like 20 minutes up front. So I got enough laughs to get off. But I had no connection with that audience.
Yeah.
There was just.
But the contrary is that if you go, when I do a presentation, and I don't think most comedians do this. When I give a presentation, first of all, I always go for the meal.
Yeah.
And I always interact with the tables. Yeah. And I will pick up talking to people something funny. And there's nothing funnier to a group of people if there's like an in-joke
right,
that only that group knows.
Right.
Because, as I said, humor is a personal thing, and it's an intellectual process. And if you say something about Joe and how he always wears a horrible tie, I mean, that's a stupid example, but everybody in the room knows that Joe wears a horrible tie, they're going to love that.
Right.
So I think that's, you know, most nightclub comedians don't do that. They come out on the stage and they're there, and that's, they've not worked the crowd.
Right.
We are talking about comedy and humor here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. Stephen, welcome to the program.
Yes, thanks.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
I'm not interested in busting out into comedy. I love my job. But what are the open mic opportunities for people who want to do some of those kinds of things, even though they're not maybe interested in a career change?
Well,
thanks very much for the call, Steve.
Yeah, yeah, Steve, the Crackers in Broad Ripple has an open stage every, I believe, every Tuesday night. You can call the Crackers in Broad Ripple and get hooked up with that. But if you go on Facebook, there's an Indianapolis comedy scene page on Facebook, and there's a bunch of locals that have open stages all over town at different nights, and there's opportunities for you to go up and try this, you know, because, again, it's you can only learn in front of an audience. The first time I ever did stand up by myself, I was at
where did you start? I mean,
I had started in like a group of us were here in Indianapolis. We would do Saturday Night Live type skits. We'd take 3 months to write skits, rehearse them, and then perform them 2 weeks at an old place called the Broad Ripple Playhouse, which is long since gone. But the first time I ever did stand up by myself was at a little place at 20 North Delaware called Drew's Pub. It's long since gone. There's a bunch of stand ups that were just trying to do an open stage there, and I was worried that I'd forget my jokes, the jokes that I had written. So I took a felt pen, and on the back of a business card, I put little reminders of my jokes so I could palm that card. So I go up on stage.
Sarah Palin, yeah.
And I just tell my first joke, nothing. Tell my second joke, nothing. Now, you've heard of flop sweat. Mm-hmm. I had the Mississippi River running down my back. I mean, it's horrible. Third joke, nothing. Staring at me. So now I just my mind has gone blank. And I thought, well, no problem. So I glanced down at my palm, and the perspiration had run the ink on the card. There was nothing there, and I just threw it away. But that's an open stage, and that's how you just got to go up, eat it, and learn. And hopefully you have the self-gumption to get back up and on the horse and try it again a second time, because when you get that first big laugh, again, it's heroin and you're hooked.
You know, there's nothing worse in the world than people who think they're funny and they're not. We all have people like that in our lives. And there's nothing worse. And everybody sort of – I think one of the best shows I ever did when I was down at Union Station doing a talk show, I had four people on the set. I had two people who were lawyers and gave up their practice to be stand-up comics, and two stand-up comics –
who should have been lawyers?
No, who went back to law school.
Okay.
And they're all looking at each other saying, what are you, nuts? What are you, nuts? What are you nuts? And everybody, it always looks like more fun on the other side. So
grass is always greener.
Yeah.
We're talking about comedy and humor here on No Limits. Frank, welcome to the program.
Well, hey, how you doing?
Just fine. What's on your mind?
Well, you know what? I'm a veteran of both these guys' show. This is Frank Dean. I used to help Dave on his show. And years ago when Dick did a hour-long show on one of his TV things of songwriters, and I was on there for him.
Oh, of course.
So good luck to both those guys. Anyway, what I was wanting to ask Dave, or maybe Dick, too, is, as Dave knows, I'm a big comedy fan, too. But what I've learned that increasingly over the years, or it seems like to me, and I wanted to get his take on it, you know, I'm a musician, and I play in a different place every week, and I try to tell a few jokes, you know, through the night too, but I've noticed that with the political climate as it is now, I have to watch what joke I tell in what area of Indiana.
Oh yeah.
You know, like I told a joke in Broad Ripple last Thursday night that was killer, and then I told it in Columbus Saturday night, and I thought they were going to call the squad on me. You know?
Right.
A few cultural differences there. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, is that a normal thing right now?
So is this a joke, Frank, is this a joke you can tell on the radio?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I just said, boy, another 3 feet of snow in Minnesota. And today, Congressman Michelle Bachmann wanted to know why snow hates America.
Well, I have
very much for the call.
First of all, I'm sorry, Dave. I was going to say, first of all, because I mean, a joke like that, which I think is funny, already eliminates everybody who doesn't know who Michelle Bachmann is.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the thing about doing jokes like that, because there's a certain amount of information you have to bring.
Which is part of Jon Stewart's argument when, you know, people accuse him of
dumbing
down the news or whatever.
Right.
He says, no. The people who get our jokes have to be paying very close attention.
Right. Mort Saul used to just take the newspaper up. You're doing current event humor, it's easy to go over the top of people's heads. Very, very easy. But no, Frank, that's our old buddy Frank Dean. Frank's guitar is right there on Jefferson Street in beautiful downtown Franklin. Go by and tell our buddy Frank's a great guy. But no, you do have to watch. There's jokes that I can't tell in Bloomington, Indiana, that will kill in Carmel.
Such as?
I used to talk about a joke about feeling uncomfortable. You know, well, I got to roast a bunch of the 500 festival people one time. Mm-hmm. Jeff Belskis from the Speedway asked me to roast them. And so we all met out to Speedway, and we had a little get-together, and then we were going to take a caravan to the restaurant where we were going to have dinner, and then I was going to roast mm-hmm. all these people that were new members of the 500 Festival, and they were all in brand-new Camaro Pace cars. Mm-hmm. And here I am in my 2004 Chevrolet Trailblazer. I felt a little out of place. I kind of felt like a pair of brown shoes at a black tie dinner, or Clydesdale in a Kentucky Derby, or Barack Obama in a Christian church. You know, I felt out of place. So you do that joke in most of conservative towns,
and it gets a huge laugh. Yeah.
You do that joke in Bloomington, and they stare at you.
Yeah.
Could we spend a minute talking about bad language? How much time have we got?
We got plenty. We've got another 7 minutes or so.
No, I think people always ask me about that, and I'd be curious about what Dave thinks too, because. There are a lot of comedians, and of course, as the manager of the club, you have to make some decisions about how blue it can get. And by blue, I actually mean using four-letter words. And I think it's really interesting. As somebody who's fascinated by jokes, when I go hear a comedian, how do I say this? Sometimes that word is necessary.
Right.
But is nothing worse when it's used gratuitously.
Right.
I could tell you a joke, which I won't now, that if I didn't use that word at the end of the joke would not be funny.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some times where you probably hear comedians and go, there's just no point. Mm-hmm. Am I right?
It's a crutch.
Yeah.
Yeah, the language is a crutch.
Yeah.
And I work on that with the young guys, and I try to tell them, I said, you're just tossing that in, and it's a crutch. You're just trying to prop up a joke that's not strong enough.
Right.
I do not audit guys' acts.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, we try to tell people this mm-hmm. act is this or is that. Mm-hmm. We had a comic on from Great Britain, a young man who just basically went up and said, I don't believe in God, and people that don't believe or the people that do believe in God are stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And
but that's not funny. So
it's not funny, but he did jokes about it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we had some enraged people, and I said, I concur with your anger, but this is America, and he can say what he wants to say, and all you can do is bless him and move on and let him do what he does.
I'm telling you, you shouldn't go to a comedy gig to a place like yours if you're prepared to be insulted. You can not think it's funny, but you have no right to be insulted.
Right.
I mean, that's the risk you're taking.
Right. And that's sort of what I was getting to. Yeah. I asked the question about risk. I mean, about making the joke. I mean, the reality is with most jokes, you've talked about how the self-deprecating ones are the best. Somebody still has to be the butt of the joke, the butt of the humor.
Right.
There has to be
or yourself.
A comic figure. Mm-hmm. But that's what we mean about the self-deprecating. Yeah. Piece, but even that, some of the self-deprecating stuff can come a little, become almost confessional, and that can make people feel a little uncomfortable, too. Who are the folks that you think are funny? I mean, who do you look to for inspiration, Dick?
In print or
either way,
or either
who
way.
Makes you laugh?
Boy, this is a weird thing to say. The funniest man who's to me, talking about B'nai B'rith and being Jewish, Jackie Mason is the funniest person. And that's because what Mason does is, you know, we always say you shouldn't stereotype people. But Jackie Mason stereotypes Jews, and he stereotypes Gentiles. And the reason stereotypes are funny is because they're based on truth.
Some reality,
And when Jackie Mason says, you know, he's doing his show, and he says, you know, intermission, he says the Gentiles are going to say, hey, you want to get a drink? You want to go to a drink? And the Jews are going to say, did you eat? Did you eat? And I'm thinking, that's just brilliant. I mean, obviously, it's not true every time, but it's just he just has a way of making that work when he does the stereotype. I love Jackie Mason. I love Seinfeld. There's a million of them.
How about Dave, you?
Man, I had a lot of comedy heroes growing up.
Yeah.
Bill Cosby,
yeah.
Carlin. Don Rickles,
mm-hmm.
Seinfeld, a lot of guys. But Jay Leno was kind of my mentor. And when he did The Tonight Show, you know, we're talking about working on jokes and stuff like that, he would do an 8, 9, 10-minute monologue 5 nights a week.
Mm-hmm.
That's 40 to 50 minutes of new jokes
every week.
Now, okay, yeah, he has a staff of writers. Yeah, he sure does. But getting that joke out Can you imagine?
And making sure it sounds like him and is the kind of joke people
You know, you don't have a chance
him.
To rewrite it.
Yeah.
You know, he would go to the Hermosa Beach Comedy and Magic Club every Sunday night and work on a lot of stuff that he was thinking about doing the next week. But he's got a chance to do it once on that stage. But then, you know, it's Tuesday and something happens in the news Tuesday afternoon. So that night he does a joke about it. His ability to do that, it was phenomenal. And if you ever saw Jay Leno live, he was a pounder. He was a banger. He just boom, 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 boom. And he'd let you up and have a breath for a couple of minutes, and then boom, boom, boom. Kind of like Dangerfield with his one-liners, except Jay was a little not all one-liners. And just one of the nicest people. It really upsets me to see him vilified by so many people with this whole thing about coming, you know, leaving the Tonight Show and then coming back. And a lot of comics like him, but a lot more don't like him for whatever reason. But he was always one of the nice people I ever ran into.
Have Dave and I back. We'll debate why I think Letterman's a better comedian.
Well, yeah.
Maybe
it's an Indianapolis thing, but I veer
toward
Letterman
myself. No, it has nothing to do with Indianapolis. It has nothing to do with
that. I veer toward Letterman myself. Yeah. But that gets to a point. I mean, one of the knocks you also hear about Letterman is that there can be kind of a cruel edge to some of his humor, too. Are there comedians or humorists you think are just too mean? And who would they be?
Boy, I don't know. I mean, I don't really listen to or watch stand-up comedy. Because if I'm not doing it, I don't want anything to do with it for the most part. I have to be involved with it at Crackers, and I'll sit and watch.
Yeah, but when I'm home, I'm off the clock.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know. There's a lot of guys that I, you know, I'll flip through and see Comedy Central and see, and I couldn't name you any names, but I just.
There's always a fear that, I mean, I have read everything by six or eight different authors, but there's always a fear that you're going to see something and you're going to unconsciously steal
it. Right.
Not on purpose, but, you know, there are, I'm sure Dave would agree, there are only so many ideas, and it inevitably, you're not the first person to do that joke.
Right.
Well, I think that probably is going to have to be the last word, but I'd like to thank both of you. Dick Woolsey, thank you for spending this time with us. I really enjoyed talking with you. And Dave Wilson, thank you for being in here. Really enjoyed talking with you. We are going to be back on Thursday when we're going to be testing some of the claims that have been made in the same-sex marriage debate, specifically about what the economic impact would be and how single-sex couples affect the raising of children. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Allseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.